Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent with Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome the club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN, or listening to us on National Public Radio, or the Internet Global Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind you of some of our upcoming speakers. On Friday, tomorrow, Abba Ibn, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, will talk about prospects for peace in the Middle East. And on June 6, former President Gerald Ford will present the Ford Foundation Journalism Awards and talk about the challenge to America. And on Tuesday, June 7, Norman Augustine, chairman and CEO of the Martin Marietta Company, will discuss the defense industry in a speech entitled, Headed for High Noon Again, the Future of the U.S. Defense Industry. Also, I'd like to mention that there will be a book and author wrap on Wednesday, June 1st, starting at 6 p.m. with Harry Jaffe and Tom Sherwood, authors of Dream City, Race, Power, and the Decline of Washington, D.C. That's there. I didn't make up that. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards available for you at your tables and pass them forward, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your left, your right, Julie Asher, news editor, Catholic News Service. Vic Ostrowitzky of Hearst Newspapers. Joan Connell of Newhouse News Service. Patrick Cody, editor of Mental Health Report. Glenn L. Sasser of the Chicago Tribune. Mary Otto of the Knight Ritter Newspapers. Reverend Michael Place, the administrative assistant to Cardinal Bernardin and research theologian for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, I have Christy Wise, the freelance journalist and the chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Jimmy Legault, executive director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois. Mary Crowley, executive editor of Business Publishers Incorporated and a member of the Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. Amy Baer of the Copley News Service. Jerry Brazda of the Brazda Healthcare Information. And finally, Steve Piacenti of the Charleston Post and Courier. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Chef Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Our speaker today is His Eminence Joseph Cardinal Bernardin, Archbishop of Chicago. There is a story that the Cardinal likes to tell of how on one of his regular visits to his ailing elderly mother, he caught her shortly after she had attended Mass. Probing gently, he asked her if she knew who he was, to which she unhesitantly responded, "The Son of God." "No," he says, he replied, "I'm not that son." Roman Catholics especially understand and find amusing this story of the doting son, for anyone who follows the church hierarchy knows that the cardinal is far more than a simple man of the cloth. He is considered a leading intellectual light of the Catholic Church in the United States for his efforts to articulate a church that is a dynamic, living community of faith in which all of its members accept responsibility for its mission and well-being. That mission, he argues, should be for what he calls a consistent ethic of life that includes just not protecting the fetus from abortion, but also promoting political and economic positions affecting poverty, unemployment, hunger, and health care. And that brings him right into the middle of the debate over health care reform. With about 600 hospitals and 1,000 long-term care facilities that serve 50 million patients annually, the Catholic Church is the largest private health care provider in the country. Cuts in federal funding have made it more difficult for Catholic hospitals to provide care for the poor and the uninsured. The Catholic Church has been a leading advocate of universal health care for decades. At the same time, abortion will be a key element in the debate. Congress must decide whether abortion will be part of the basic benefits package the government offers. That issue alone can split constituencies for a reform bill. That leaves the question of whether the church will sacrifice its opposition to abortion in order to obtain universal health care. A native of Columbia, South Carolina, Cardinal Bernardin comes to the debate with a keen awareness of the struggle poor families have in attaining health care. His father died when he was six, and his mother faced what he now simply calls many obstacles in order to provide for him and his sister. This background helps to explain his support for such things as Chicago's parish-based parenting programs, his outspokenness on federal spending for poverty programs, his efforts against racism, urban divisiveness, and violence, and his push as chairman of the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Marriage and Family Life for strong stands against domestic violence and child abuse. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for His Eminence, Joseph Cardinal Bernardin, Archbishop of Chicago.
Thank you very much, Gil. And that story about my mother is true. Before I start, I'd like to mention that sometime during the course of this program, you will be receiving the text of my talk. For the sake of time, I'm deleting a few paragraphs and a few phrases, but those paragraphs and phrases are an integral part of my presentation. As many of you know, in the last year, I have experienced a significant amount of press coverage for reasons that are happily behind me. There is a temptation in this prestigious forum to share some of my reactions and reflections based on that experience, but I'm going to resist that temptation. At another time, and after more reflection on my part, I might share some thoughts about what I learned about the news media and related topics. But today, I address a more important and more timely topic, the moral dimensions of healthcare reform. I believe that at the heart of so many of our problems, there is a fundamental lack of respect for human life and human dignity. Over the past 10 years, I have articulated a consistent ethic of life as a moral framework to address the growing violence in our midst. The purpose of the consistent ethic is to provide a moral framework for analysis and motivation for action on a wide range of human life issues with important ethical dimensions. The consistent life ethic, by design, provides for a public discourse that respects the separation of church and state and also recognizes the proper role of religious perspectives and ethical convictions in the public life of a pluralistic society. Over the past years, I have addressed many issues in the light of the consistent ethic. In addition to the central question of abortion, I have spoken about euthanasia and assisted suicide, capital punishment, the newer technologies used to assist human reproduction, and war and peace, to name a few. The foundation for all of these discussions is a deep conviction about the nature of human life, namely that human life is sacred, which means that all human life has an inalienable dignity that must be protected and respected from conception to natural death. For advocates of a consistent life ethic, the national debate about healthcare reform, represents both an opportunity and a test. It's an opportunity to address issues and policies that are often matters of life and death, such as who is covered and who is not, which services are included and which are not. Will reform protect human life and enhance dignity, or will it threaten or undermine life and dignity? It is a test in the sense that we will be measured by the comprehensiveness of our concerns and the consistency of our principles in this area. In this current debate, a consistent life ethic approach to healthcare requires that we stand up for both the unserved and the unborn, to insist on the inclusion of real universal coverage and the exclusion of abortion coverage, to support efforts to restrain rising health costs, and to oppose the denial of needed care to the poor and the vulnerable. In standing with the unserved and the unborn, the uninsured and the undocumented, we bring together our pro-life and social justice values. They are the starting points for a consistent life agenda for health care reform. In these remarks, I speak as a pastor of a diverse local church. In Chicago, we see both the strengths and the difficulties of our current system. We experience the remarkable dedication, professionalism, and caring of the people, and the amazing contributions of the institutions that make up our healthcare system. I also see children without care, the sick without options, the communities without adequate health services, the families and businesses strained and broken by healthcare costs. We see the hurts and pick up the pieces of a failing system in our hospitals and clinics, our shelters and agencies, our parishes and schools. We look at healthcare reform from the bottom up, not who wins or loses politically, not how it impacts powerful institutions and professions, but how it touches the poor and vulnerable, the unserved and the unborn, the very young and the very old. I am also a member of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, an organization deeply involved in this debate. Our principles and priorities are summarized in a resolution unanimously adopted by the conference last year, a copy of which is on the table at the entrance. The broader healthcare debate is driven by many factors. For the sake of time, I will list only five without discussing them at any length. First, the amount of money spent on healthcare is escalating at an unsustainable rate. It surpassed 14% of the gross domestic product last year, and it's reasonable to assume that without effective intervention, it could reach 18% of the GDP by the year 2000. Second, this uncontrolled growth is creating economic hardships for many of our fellow citizens, especially working families. Third, private insurance programs are deteriorating through risk segmentation into programs that more and more serve those who have the least need for health insurance, the healthy. Fourth, cost shifting, that is, the passing on of unreimbursed expenses by health providers to employer premiums, has become a hidden tax that is no longer sustainable. Fifth, and finally, and most significantly, the number of uninsured in the United States continues, now approaching nearly 40 million. A large portion of whom are people who work. 10 million are children. I join the many who have concluded that the U.S. needs profound systemic change in its healthcare system. We cannot rely on the system to correct itself. Without intervention, things are getting worse, not better. I hasten to add that my advocacy is not partisan. Neither do I argue on behalf of any particular proposal before the Congress. I do, however, take exception with those who say that there is no serious systemic problem, or that what we face is merely an insurance or a healthcare delivery problem. On the contrary, there is a fundamental healthcare problem in our nation today. I share this judgment with many leaders of the Catholic community, whose outlook and convictions have been shaped by the experience of Catholic religious communities and dioceses, that operates 600 hospitals and 300 long-term care facilities, constituting the largest nonprofit group of healthcare providers in the United States, by the experience of the Catholic Church in the United States, which purchases health coverage for hundreds of thousands of employees and their families, by the experience of Catholic Charities, the largest private deliverer of social services in the nation, by our experience as a community of faith, caring for those who fall through the cracks of our current system. It is this broad range of experience that led the U.S. Catholic bishops to say last June, and I quote, "Now is the time for real health care reform. It is a matter of fundamental justice. We urge our national leaders to look beyond special interest claims and partisan differences, to unite our nation in a new commitment to meet the health care needs of our people, especially the poor and the vulnerable. This is a major political task, a significant policy challenge, and a moral imperative." End of quote. Before addressing some of the more specific issues associated with health care reform, it's important that we consider some even more profound issues. I say this because President Clinton's health care reform proposal and the alternatives to it, like any significant government initiatives that would reorder social relationships and responsibilities, have drawn us into a discussion of fundamental values and social convictions. Several important convictions, which serve as a kind of bedrock for the consistent life ethic, can assist us in this broader discussion. They are, first, there are basic goods and values which we human beings share because we share the gift of human life. These goods and values serve as the common ground for a public morality that guides our actions as a nation and as a society. Second, within the individual, these common goods and values express themselves in an inalienable human dignity with consequent rights and duties. Third, one of the ways these rights and duties are expressed in the human community is through the recognition and pursuit of the common good, or to say it differently, through a good that is to be pursued in common with all of society, a good that ultimately is more important than the good of any individual. Fourth, this common good is realized in the context of a living community, which is nurtured by the virtues and shared values of individuals. Such a community protects the basic rights of individuals. Fifth, as part of this community, both individuals and institutions have an obligation which is rooted in distributive justice to work to secure this common good. This is how we go about meeting the reasonable claims of citizens striving to realize and experience their fundamental human dignity. These convictions find their origin in a vision of the human person as someone who is grounded in community and in an understanding of society and government as being largely responsible for the realization of the common good. As Catholics, we share this vision with many others. It is consistent with fundamental American values, though grounded differently. For example, our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution reflect a profound insight that has guided the development of our nation, namely, that there are certain fundamental rights that exist before the creation of any social contract, such as the constitution of a sovereign nation, and that these must be protected by society and government. As a nation, we also have had a sense of a common good which is greater than the agenda of any individual. We have also been a nation of communities. Whether in the small towns of the plains or the ethnic communities of the larger cities, U.S. citizens had a sense of being bonded together and being mutually responsible. We also recognize that our individual and collective existence is best protected by virtuous living, balancing the demands of personhood and social responsibility. In more recent years, as our social order has become more complex, we have come to see that a proper sense of mutual responsibility requires a greater presence of the state in helping individuals to realize their human potential and social responsibility. Public education, and Social Security are but two examples of this presence. Without being overly pessimistic, I suggest that these fundamental convictions, which are essential both to a consistent life ethic and to our well-being as a nation and a society, are being challenged today. There is abroad a certain tendency that would suggest that law and public order are accountable only to the subjective convictions of individuals or pressure groups, not to any objective, albeit imperfectly perceived, moral order. All of this needs to be taken into consideration in any substantive discussion of healthcare reform. If we are not attentive to issues such as these, then our dialogues and debates will go nowhere because of disagreements on basic principles. First, there is the issue of universal access. In the June 1993 statement I cited earlier, the U.S. Catholic bishops outlined key principles and priorities for initiating and executing reform. Our third principle was universal access to comprehensive health care for every person living in the United States. We believe that health care, including preventive and primary care, is not only a commodity, it is an essential safeguard of human life and dignity. In 1981, the bishops spoke of health care as a basic human right which flows from the sanctity of human life. In declaring this, the bishops were not saying that a person had a right to health, but that since the common good is the sum of those conditions necessary to preserve human dignity, one must have a right of access, insofar as it is possible, access to those goods and services which will allow a person to maintain or regain health. And if one views this right within the context of the convictions I have just discussed, then it is the responsibility of society as a whole and government to ensure that there is a common social order that makes the realization of this good possible. Whether we have health care should not depend on whom we work for, how much our parents earn, or where we live. So far, so good. Most would agree, at least in theory. Where the disagreement comes is in regard to the last of the convictions I noted in discussing the consistent ethic. Allow me to rephrase it. Under the title of distributive justice, society has the obligation to meet the reasonable claims of its citizens so that they can realize and exercise their fundamental human rights. When many of us Americans think of justice, we tend to think of what we can claim from one another. There is an individualistic understanding of justice. But there is another American instinct that has a broader understanding of justice. It has been summarized by Father Philip Keane, a moral theologian, who wrote, quote, "Justice shifts our thinking from what we claim from each other to what we owe to each other. Justice is about duties and responsibilities, about building the good community." End of quote. In this perspective, distributive justice is the obligation which falls upon society to meet the reasonable expectations of its citizens so that they can realize and exercise their fundamental human rights. And in this instance, the right is that of access to those goods and services that make it possible for persons to maintain their health and thus broaden health care beyond what is provided by a hospital, a clinic, or a physician. So far, I have argued that health care is an essential safeguard of human life and dignity, and that there is an obligation for society to ensure that a person be able to realize this right. I now want to go a step further. I believe that the only way this obligation can be effectively met by society is for our nation to make universal health care coverage a reality. Universal access is not enough. We can no longer tolerate being the only Western nation that leaves millions of persons uncovered. When I speak of universal coverage, I do not mean a vague promise or a rhetorical preamble to legislation, but the practical means and sufficient investment to permit all to obtain decent health care on a regular basis. If justice is a hallmark of our national community, then we must fulfill our obligations in justice to the poor and the unserved first and not last. In a similar way, we cannot ignore the millions of undocumented immigrants. Even if the demands of justice were set aside, reasons of public health would necessitate their being included. The undocumented will continue to need medical assistance, and hospitals will continue to be required to provide medical care for those who present themselves for treatment. In a reformed system, which should contain, if not eliminate, the cost shifting that previously had paid for their care, the medical expenses of the undocumented must be covered for both policy and moral reasons. Unfortunately, as the national debate on health care reform has evolved, and as legislation has been proposed, an important fact has been lost, namely, that it's not enough simply to expand coverage. If real reform is to be achieved, that is, reform that will ensure quality and cost-effective care, then we must do what is necessary in order to ensure that our health care delivery system is person-centered and has a community focus. Health care cannot be successfully reformed if it is considered only an economic matter. This form reform will be morally blighted if the nature of care, something profoundly human, not easily measured, yet that which far more than technology remains the heart and breath of the art of healing, is not preserved and expanded along with health coverage itself. The challenge is to provide universal coverage without seriously disrupting the doctor-patient relationship, which is so central to good medical care. After a long period of research and discussion, the Catholic Health Association developed a proposal for healthcare reform that seeks to meet this and other challenges. It is called Setting Relationships Right. I hope that the values CHA has proposed and the strategies it has developed in this regard will not be lost sight of. Our objective must be a healthy nation where the mental and physical health of the individual is addressed through collaborative efforts at the local level. Let me summarize my major points so far. First, we need a profound systemic reform of our healthcare system. Second, justice and the common good demand that this reform include universal coverage. Third, justice at this time requires a program of effective universal coverage that is person-centered and community-based. This leads to two thorny questions. How is the program to be funded, and how are the costs to be contained? As you know, these two questions are essentially interrelated. It is clear that the rate of cost increases in healthcare cannot be sustained even if there is no systemic reform. It also is clear that the demands of a more fiscally responsible use of federal monies must be taken into account. We can't spend what we don't have. Our Episcopal Conference has insisted that healthcare reform must also include effective mechanisms to restrain rising healthcare costs. Without cost containment, we cannot make healthcare affordable and direct scarce national resources to other pressing national problems. Containing costs is crucial if we are to avoid dangerous pressures toward the kind of rationing that raises fundamental ethical and equity questions. The poor, vulnerable, and uninsured persons cannot be denied needed care because the health system refuses to eliminate waste, duplication, and bureaucratic costs. But we may also have to consider other steps to restrain costs and distribute health care more justly. For example, we may have to recognize that basic and preventive care and health care to preserve and protect life should be a higher priority than purely elective procedures. This raises the often explosive concept of rationing. I prefer a different word and a different concept, namely stewardship. How do we best protect human life and enhance human dignity in a situation of limited health resources? How do we ensure that the lives and health of the poor and vulnerable are not less valuable or less a priority than the lives and health of the rest of us? This is not an abstract discussion. Rationing health care is a regular, if unacknowledged, feature of our current health care system. Nearly 40 million are uninsured, 50 million more are underinsured. In 1992, nearly 10 million children were without medical coverage, 400,000 more than in 1991. Being without insurance means being without care when you need it. Delaying care until an illness or injury may require more costly intervention or be beyond any treatment. We now have an insurance model that requires individuals to pay for the items and services which their health care needs require, some without limitations and others with enormous constraints. We have been rationing health care in recent years by squeezing people out of the system through insurance marketing techniques like medical underwriting, pre-existing condition exclusion, and insurance redlining. Actuarial pricing designed to protect insurance company assets pits one group against another, the old against the young, the sick against the healthy, thus undermining the solidarity of the whole community. We can see this tension playing itself out in the disturbing debates around this country about assisted suicide. In light of these concerns, the nation must undertake a broad-based and inclusive consideration of how we will choose to allocate and share our health care dollars. We are stewards, not sole owners, of all of our resources, human and material. Thus, goods and services must be shared. This is not a task for government alone. Institutions and individuals must be involved in reaching a shared moral consensus, which will allow us to reassert the essential value of the person as an individual and as a member of the community. From that moral consensus must come a process of decision-making and resource allocation that preserves the dignity of all persons, in particular the most vulnerable. It is proper for society to establish limits on what it can reasonably provide in one area of the commonweal so that it can address other legitimate responsibilities to the community. But in establishing such limits, the inalienable life and dignity of every person, in particular the vulnerable, must be protected. The Catholic Health Association has addressed the ethics of rationing and offered some moral criteria. These demand that any acceptable plan must meet a demonstrable need, be oriented to the common good, apply to all, result from an open and participatory process, give priority to disadvantaged persons, be free of wrongful discrimination, and be monitored in its social and economic effects. This kind of framework offers a far better guidance than the moral bankruptcy of assisted suicide and the ethically unacceptable withholding of care based on quality of life criteria. But the problem of rationed access to necessary medical care is only one aspect of the cost containment debate. What of the issue of funding? Obviously, I can't offer detailed analysis of the specific proposals which are on the table. But I can say this: if systemic reform addresses in a substantive manner issues of quality care and cost effectiveness, then justice will demand that all sectors of our society contribute to the support of these efforts. And this support takes two forms. First, each individual must assume appropriate responsibility for the costs associated with health care and must assume responsibility to do all that is possible not to put his or her health at risk. Second, those segments of our economic order which have been able to avoid an appropriate level of responsibility for the health care of their employees must begin to assume their fair share, just as the rest of society must. Thus far, I have insisted that a consistent life ethic requires a commitment to genuine universal coverage, because lack of coverage threatens the lives and diminishes the dignity of millions of men, women, and children. I must also say clearly and emphatically that a consistent life ethic requires us to lift the burden of mandated abortion coverage from needed health care reform. And I say this for several important reasons. First, it is morally wrong to coerce millions of people into paying for the destruction of unborn children against their consciences and convictions. How ironic it would be if advocates of choice, as they call themselves, require me and millions like me to obtain and pay for abortion coverage, which we abhor. It is a denial of choice, a violation of conscience, and a serious blow to the common good. Second, it is politically destructive. Needed national health care reform must not be burdened by abortion coverage, which neither the country nor the Congress supports. Public opinion polls and recent congressional action clearly indicate that whatever their views on the morality or legality of abortion, the American people and their representatives do not wish to coerce all citizens into paying for procedures that so divide our nation. A University of Cincinnati poll in January of this year indicated that only 30% favor the inclusion of abortion as a basic benefit, even if it could be included at no cost at all. Only 14% wanted abortion coverage if it would add to the cost of health premiums. Third, abortion mandates would undermine the participation of Catholic and other religious providers of health care who now provide essential care in many of the nation's most underserved communities. I fear our hospitals will be unable to fulfill their mission and meet their responsibilities in a system where abortion is a mandated benefit. Strong conscience clauses are necessary to deal with a variety of medical moral issues, but are not sufficient to protect Catholic and other providers who find abortion morally objectionable. The only remedy is not to link needed reform to abortion mandates. The sooner the burden of abortion mandates is lifted, the better for the cause of reform. We continue to insist that it would be a grave moral tragedy, a serious policy mistake, and a major political error to link healthcare reform to abortion. An insistence on abortion coverage will turn millions of advocates of reform into adversaries of healthcare legislation. We cannot and will not support reform that fails to offer universal coverage or that insists on abortion mandates. This is our consistent ethic message to the White House, the Congress, and the country. We are advocates of these key principles and priorities, not any particular plan. We will not choose between our key priorities. We will work with the leaders of our land to pass healthcare reform, reform that reflects a true commitment to human life and human dignity. We will carry this message forward with civility and consistency. We offer our moral convictions and practical experience, not political contributions and endorsements. We have no attack ads and we have no PAC funds, but we can be a valuable partner for reform, and we will work tirelessly for real reform without abortion mandates. For defenders of human life, there is no more important or timely task than offering an ethical and effective contribution to the healthcare debate. The discussions and decisions over the next months will tell us a lot, a great deal, about what kind of society we are and will become. We must ask ourselves, what are the choices, investments, and sacrifices we're willing to make in order to protect and enhance the life and dignity of all, especially the poor and vulnerable? In the nation's capital, healthcare reform is seen primarily as a political challenge, but fundamentally, healthcare reform is a moral challenge. Finding the values and vision to reshape a major part of national life to protect better the life and dignity of all. Ultimately, this debate is not simply about politics, about which party or interest group prevails. It is about children, children who die because of the lack of prenatal care or the violence of abortion, about people, people who have no health care because of where they work or where they come from, about communities, communities without care, and workers without coverage. Healthcare reform is both a political task and a moral test. As a religious community with much at stake and much to contribute to this debate, we are working and we are working hard for healthcare reform that truly reaches out to the unserved, protects the unborn, and advances the common good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The first question, we have many of them up here, so the first one will be one of my own. In listening to you, it sounded like you were almost advocating a single-payer plan, a government where the government pays for all of health care. Is that what you would consider a preferred form, so that the government provides the access, ensures the access without going through a private insurance system?
I did not advocate that or no. even imply that.
And
I,
okay. what options or leverage will the church employ if lawmakers insist on including abortion coverage in the health care reform?
Well, basically, we are teachers. That's our primary responsibility, to address social issues which confront us, and to address them especially from a moral or ethical dimension. And as I indicated in my talk, we believe that consistency, and as I indicated, I have developed this consistent life ethic over a period of a decade, consistency requires, in the case of healthcare reform, two things, and they must be united. They must be joined together. One is universal coverage. Everyone is entitled to adequate health care. And the other is the exclusion of abortion. We're working hard on this, and we believe that it's possible to bring about a reform that will meet those two criteria. And we are working very hard on that. But basically, it is through persuasion.
Do you see any kind of alliance, say, with the Southern Baptists, other anti-abortion groups, to try and put a concerted effort on Congress on this?
Yes. But the alliance must be with those groups that will support both of the two things that I have been pushing or insisting on, namely universal coverage and the exclusion of abortion.
Do you see groups like the Southern Baptists supporting universal health care enough to be joining on the other side?
I would hope so. I have not had any direct discussions with their leaders on that particular point.
Would you be willing to testify before Congress to oppose the inclusion of abortion in a national health plan?
I would. If invited.
If invited. Senator Edward Kennedy, of course, opposes this. Do you see, as a good Catholic, do you see a problem here with the some Catholic members in Congress pushing for putting abortion into this plan?
Well, I would see difficulty with anyone who would insist on abortion being covered. But I would be also, I would find it very difficult to deal with those who are not for universal coverage. I think the two, consistency requires that we keep the two together.
You stated, this question says that you stated that health care reform should not be an economic matter, but as a former hospital lobbyist, I know that Catholic hospitals, as well as private hospitals around the country, have closed inner city hospitals because of financial reasons. What can be done to get health care resources into the areas which need them most?
What I said was it was not only an economic matter. I think that much of what I said indicated that there are very serious economic dimensions to this. The point that I was making at that particular point in the talk was that there are other considerations that also have to be taken into account. No one would be more aware than I of the problems that some of our hospitals are facing. Since I went to Chicago 12 years ago, I have been working very hard with the sponsors and the administrators of our 20 Catholic hospitals to make them as viable as possible. Admittedly, a number of these hospitals serve the inner city, and they are experiencing all kinds of difficulties. Indeed, we have lost one or two hospitals already because of economic problems. But even aside from healthcare reform, which is now being debated and hopefully will be passed, in the Archdiocese, I established, with the help of our 20 hospitals, a Catholic Health Alliance to make it possible for them to work together more closely. And now this is going a step further. A number of them, and I hope ultimately all of them, will be involved in a network that will be supportive of all of the hospitals, especially those that operate in the poorest sections of the city.
What do you believe are the chances that abortion will be excluded from whatever health care plan ultimately passes Congress? Isn't it with the Democrats firmly in control there, isn't it a foregone conclusion that this will be included?
Well, I would hope that they would listen to the polls or look at the polls. I cited this one poll, for example, that was done by the University of Cincinnati. That is one of the most recent polls. And well over 2,000 people participated in that national or nationwide study. And only 30% said that they were willing to include abortion as part of the basic benefit package. But if they had to pay more for it, only 14% said that they were willing to do that. And so I think that we need to listen to the people.
Would you be satisfied with a consciousness clause in the health care reform exempting Catholic hospitals from an abortion mandate? Would that still leave Catholic citizens subsidizing abortions at other hospitals?
I think that conscience clauses are necessary because there are ethical problems other than abortion that must be dealt with in our hospitals. But conscience clauses in themselves would not address the problem that I have just been referring to. If you have a system where abortion coverage is mandated, well then you're obligated to pay for it through, as a citizen, through the taxes that you pay. You may be obligated to do it as an employer. For example, the Archdiocese of Chicago is a corporation sole, not counting the Catholic colleges and universities and the hospitals themselves and other institutions which are not part of the corporation sole. We have more than 20,000 employees on our payroll. And I don't want to have to provide or to pay for something that is morally reprehensible. So I'm convinced that conscience, another thing that I should mention in this regard, it's true that if there's a conscience clause, a Catholic hospital may opt not to provide abortion, but then would it be accepted by whatever network is established in the area? There's a great fear that such a hospital would be marginalized.
By not providing for abortion, would not you be almost overturning Roe versus Wade, which would really tear at the basic fabric of what has been happening for the last 20 years?
I don't think so. Roe versus Wade. It granted a right, but it did not say that it had to be funded. It did not make the funding of this obligatory.
Then doesn't that leave the poor and the ones who are the least able to do this to pay for it again stuck at the with having the unwanted children while the rich can still have abortions?
That argument is made, and it has a certain appeal. I admit that. But I think that there are two things that have to be taken into account, and that is, what is abortion all about? We believe that it is the unjust taking of innocent human life, and that is wrong. Now, the other side of the coin is that we have to do everything in our power to address those things that cause people to feel that abortion is a real solution for whatever problem they happen to be facing. One of the things that kind of upsets me at times is that, and I'm speaking in a very personal way, I've been a priest for 42 years, I've been a bishop for 28 years, and my position on abortion has never changed, it has never wavered. But sometimes the impression is given that I or the church or whoever, that we're only interested in condemning abortion, that we're not interested in a positive way of helping people, helping women who find themselves in difficult situations, addressing the causes, societal causes that lead to abortion. And as a matter of fact, most of our time and most of our effort and most of our resources are spent precisely doing that.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned the charges against you, or the unfortunate incident that and kind of left people hanging, especially out in the radio and television audience. These, of course, were sex abuse charges that were later the accuser said that were fabricated. So there were two questions here. First of all, do you see such accusations as another manifestation of a growing public fear, even paranoia, about priests, and has this concern become a barrier to the recruitment of young men to the priesthood? And second of all, could you comment on the how the media coverage of that whole issue? I'll take up the rest of time.
first of all, when we talk about sexual abuse, especially the sexual abuse of minors or children, we're talking about a societal problem, not merely a problem that affects the church or the priesthood. Now, having said that, obviously, when a person in a trusted position, like a priest, abuses someone, actually, whether a minor or not, that's a very serious matter that has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed in a very effective way. And we are doing that. And as you know, I think most of you know, that I have taken the lead in responding to that problem, and will continue to do so. Obviously, my case brought up the question of repressed memory, and how reliable is repressed memory? When can it be used? And this, you know, is a question. It's a question that I have, but it's a question that a lot of other people have, because in the newspapers and television in recent months, we've seen other similar cases. And just recently, a gentleman in California was given an award. He was awarded some money because he claims that his daughter was manipulated by her therapist. So it's not up to me to say when is repressed memory valid, when it is not valid. This is something for the experts to decide. But I do think that a great deal of thought needs to be given to that. And there's another distinction that has to be made, too. When is it used for therapeutic reasons, and when is it used for legal purposes? These are questions that need to be researched. They need to be discussed so that there will be a better understanding of them. In regard to whether the publicity that we have gotten regarding the question of sexual abuse within the church, whether that has deterred young men from considering priesthood, I have no way of knowing for sure. I am afraid that that it has had perhaps a negative effect to some extent, but I also have to say that there are still many who are opting for priesthood. I just ordained 11. There will be two more before the year is over for the Archdiocese of Chicago. We have a good group coming in, and so I think that they are able to put things in perspective. In other words, they make a distinction, as I think people generally make, between the problems of a few and the goodness of the many or the majority. In terms of whether or how I feel about the way the media dealt with my case, overall, okay. I have to say that I was somewhat concerned about the way in which CNN handled it, because I had fallen from grace even before I had seen the lawsuit that had been brought against me. But I have to say that CNN did carry live around the world that press conference, which I think made a big difference. I think it helped to clear the air. And then when I was vindicated, they were there to do the same thing again. So I was not too happy with the way they handled it, but at the same time, they made their facilities available. But overall, I must say that I thought the press, the media, were quite objective. I really have no big complaints about that.
I'm afraid we are out of time, although there are many, many more questions here. But before asking the last question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for being here, and a National Press Club mug, which I'm sure will go well there, and take that to Rome with you, which of course leads us to the last question. One of these mugs is available to the Pope. He is, I understand, coming to Baltimore in the fall, and we have sent him an invitation to speak here, which would be quite a coup, to say the least. Could you put in a good word for
him? I'll put in a good word for you.
Thank you very much.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.